So I think that that's really what the connection is over there. But at the same time, as we can see, so what is the conclusion then? If the world itself, including paradise, is only 1/60th, let's say, of the size of Gehinnom, so he says, Nimsa kol olam kulei ki kisui kedeira l'Gehinnom. So the whole world is only like a pot cover over Gehinnom. Gehinnom is a great big pot, and this is only the size of the cover itself on top of it. See. Yes, Shemrim, but there are those who say Gehinnom English here, that you can't measure. I mean, it's limitless. Yes, Shemrim, and there are those who say Eden English here, that Eden too has no share. Omer Rabbi Shaya, so this is a little different, though. It says, Rabbi Shaya says, Maidichsiv, what is the meaning of the Pasuk when it says, Shochenis Almayim Rabim, Rabba Seitzoris? Now, this is in a chapter in the latter part of the Sefer Yirmiyahu, where he speaks about some of the various nations. This particular nation talks about Babel, about Babylonia. Okay? So he says in reference to Babylonia that this land dwells, Shochenis, right, Almayim Rabim, over many waters, Rabasa Taros, and it is rich, it is great, and in its treasures. Mi Goram the Bovel. Now he says, what made it possible for Babylonia, Sheyahu Otsorsehu Meleos Bar, that it's Otsaros, you know the word Otsaros, right? That its treasure stores are filled with rain. In other words, what makes this land so fertile? So Heve Yomer, you have to say that it is with Nesha Shochenes Hamayim Rabim. It's because it dwells upon many, many waters. And as we know, Babylonia essentially enjoyed two very large rivers. One of them is, of course, the Tigris. The other one is the Euphrates, or in Hebrew, one of them would be called the Dekel, and the other one is the Harpras, okay? And what do they have in between these two rivers? The answer is that they had all kinds of canals. They had a whole system of canals worked out between these two rivers, and these canals were used not only for navigation, but the canals were also used primarily for irrigation. So that the land, therefore, became very fertile because all you had to do is to tap water, you know, from the irrigation. And you could run it over your field and so on. Of course, in the Gemara, you know, like in let's say, in Baba Basra and so on, you know, they deal with these problems, you know, about people trying to trample on the water rights of their neighbors or something like that. You know, it could be a suit, right, to be the issue of a lawsuit. So, you know, you had to know how to regulate the water and so on. But the point is that they had water in plentitude.
Well, it says the parsec is about 2.3 to 2.9 miles.
How much?
2.3 to 2.9 miles.
Yeah, let's say approximately about 2.5 miles. Yeah. David, what did you want to say?
Say the area that you spoke about, I guess, in the vernacular, is always called the Fertile Crescent.
Yeah, right. And there's no question, I mean, that this was a very, very fertile territory. I mean, it took, of course, the genius of Saddam Hussein and so on. The Arabs. The Arabs came and they destroyed the irrigation systems and everything else. Arabs, what are you going to do with them?
Yeah.
Well, and Rabin says it's not going to stop our peace process in spite of all the explosions, the terror, murders and so on. Alright, anyway, getting back to the text over here, Omar Rav, and Rav said Asira Babel. Asira over here is, you know, it's Aramaic meaning rich. It's like the Hebrew word Ashira, understand?
Mm-hmm.
So Babel is rich, the Chatzto B'loi Mitra, in that they can plow it, they can reap in it, they can harvest it below Mitra without even rain.
Hmm.
It's not even dependent upon rainfall,
so
because it has so much water from the rivers and the canals and everything else. Omar Abaye, and Abaye said, Naktinan, we have a tradition that says, Tovani it's better to have a land which sinks under the weight of water, in other words, you know, a very wet land, below Yavshani and not a dry land. If you want to, you know, to have a land which will yield plenty, it's better to have a well-watered one than to have a dry land. Okay. The new Mishnah. The Gimel v'Machesh when Sholin Sakshon. Now, the Mishnah starts by saying that on the third day of Cheshvan, that's when you're supposed to begin saying the same Talmud of the Bracha. Okay? Rabbi Gamliel Omer, but Rabbi Gimel says, Peshivabo. Says that you have to do it on the seventh day of the month of Cheshvan, Tesvav Yom, which would be 15 days, Achar Achag, after the conclusion of Sukkot. Why? Kadesh Yagir Achren Shab Yisrael in the Haparas. So that the last pilgrims who are in Israel will be able finally to reach Euphrates River. In other words, if they came in on foot from Babylonia in order to make the pilgrimage to Yerushalayim, it would take them 15 days in order to get back to the Euphrates River, back to Babylonia. And as I pointed out to you, in Eretz Israel, this is exactly what they do. On the 7th of Cheshvan, this is when they begin saying Talamot on the phone. Omer Rabbi Elozer, so Rabbi Elozer says, Halochik Rabbi Gamliel, says Halochik Takafalas Rabbi Gamliel, namely that you begin saying it on the 7th. Tanya. Now, we have another baraita at this particular point, and this is in reference to our own practice. Chananya Omer, Chananya says about Golo, he says in the diaspora, when do we begin saying Talamoto? He says Ad Shishim Bat Kufa. He says until the 60th day in the fall season, then you have to begin saying it. So now the question is, Omer Rav Huna Bar Chiya, Omer Shmuel. So Rav Huna Bar Chiya says in the name of Shmuel that Halacha Ki Chananya, right? He says Halacha Takapal is Chananya, in other words, the 60th day. And they say, Eini, isn't this so? Oh, boy, Mine Mishmuel. But then they ask Shmuel, May Emas Ban Chiron, the Saint Halabotar, when do we begin to mention Saint Halabotar? So Amaluhu, he said to them, Mechima Ayalate Sivi Devei Tavuz Rishbo. He says, the simon that you have, you know, for the time to begin saying Talamotar is the time when you see that they bring pieces of wood, what we would say, you know, like a firewood, okay, to the home of Tavos Rishbo. Rishbo means the guy who hunts for birds, right? Or fowler, as they say in English, okay? So apparently he was a very well-known character, a very rich person, and he had a host of servants. And what did they notice? They noticed that when he realized that the rainy season was about to begin, so at this particular point he would gather all the firewood, they would bring it to his home. So it's a simon. Of course, it's a good simon if you're around where his house is. It doesn't help us very much, because we don't know who is Mr. Thomas, the bird hunter. So, Morris says, Dilma, Edom, Yidichashiru, says maybe they both refer to exactly the same season. In other words, 60 days. But now the question is, you know, so the question was raised, Yom Shishim, this 60th day that we're talking about, Kilifnei Shishim or Kilacha Shishim? Do you consider it as being with the days that precede the 60th, or do you consider it as being among those days that follow the 60th? In other words, when we say about the 60th, does it mean that on the 60th day we still do not say Talamotar? In other words, as with the days preceding it? Or do we say that at this particular day we do begin saying Talamota, so this is like the days that are going to follow? This is the question that they're asking, because, you know, Ad Shishim, it's indeterminate, so that's why the question was asked. What do we mean? So we see that there's a difference of opinion. Toshma, come and listen, he says, Rav Omayim Shishim, Kila Acha Shishim. Rav says that the 60th is like those that follow. In other words, on the 60th day you begin already saying Talamotar. Ushmuel Omar, but Shmuel says, Yoim Shishim Kilifte Shishim. He says the 60th day is like those that precede. In other words, you don't begin on the 60th, but you begin on the day following the 60th. Omer Rav Nachman by Yitzchok. So Rav Nachman by Yitzchok said, the Simonoch, I give you a simon, he says, you know, as to whose opinion. Is it Rav's opinion or is it Shmuel's opinion? He says, Eloi bo maya, tatoi le bo maya. Says those are in the upper areas, they're the ones who need the water. Those who are in the lower areas, they don't need the water as soon. Why? Because they'll have the, you know, the water coming in from the upper region, so that they can afford to wait a day. So in other words, if we identify it now with the opinion, so Rav would be typical of those who are in the upper part, and Shmuel would be typical of those in the lower part. How do they explain some of these things? There are two explanations for this. One explanation is the explanation which is given by Rashi. Rashi says that Rav came from Eretz Yisrael. This we know. I mean, he came, he learned in Eretz Yisrael, and then he came to Babylonia in order to found his yeshiva over there. So that Eloi then might be in reference to Eretz Yisrael. That is, he came from that area, because Eretz Yisrael, as we say, is Gavoa Bikol Arotzes, it's higher than all the other lands. You know, maybe they hadn't explored Mount Everest yet in those days, but, you know, spiritually it's higher, there's no question. I mean, you go to Yerushalayim, you know, you're in the real spiritual realm, you know, over there, right? So, since he came from Eretz Yisrael, so therefore, he realized that you have to have rain a little bit sooner, and therefore that's what the Eloi refers to, whereas Tatoi Shmuel was already in Babylonia, so he could afford to wait another day. This is one explanation. This is how Rashi takes it. But there's another explanation, namely, where were the two yeshivas? Rav's yeshiva is compared to Shmuel's yeshiva. So the answer is that Rav's yeshiva actually happened to be, you know, closer to the beginning, to the origin, let's say, to a higher region, so to speak, of Babylonia, so that he would be the Eloi, and then Shmuel would be Tatoi, you know, the lower part. In other words, where his yeshiva was located was already in the lower part of the country, and therefore didn't need the water that desperate. So at any rate, we still didn't answer the question, so who does the halacha follow? So this is what the Gemara now says. Omar Rav Papa, so Rav Papa says, Hilchaso, he says, the halacha is, Yoim Shishim Kedacha Shishim, that the 60th day is like those that follow. In other words, on the 60th day of the Kufas Tishrei, as we would say, the Tishrei season, that's when you begin to say. Okay, so now of course, yes.
Are they making a big deal on one day?
Yes.
Yeah,
a day makes a difference, no?
Well, I don't know. That's why I want to know.
It could make a difference in our life, too.
Well, I understand, but...
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, they had that decided. But our Papa comes along and he says, what is the final decision? The decision is as follows. Of course, there's one other thing to mention. To us, if I were to ask you, when does the fall season begin? The answer, of course, would be September 21st, or thereabouts, September 20th, 21st, I mean, something in that area, okay? All right, so add 60 to it, figure out what is the 60th day, so what are you going to have? October 21st, November 21st. Just when do we actually begin the Seder?
November 4th.
Yeah, around the 4th or 5th or something like that, right? So what is the discrepancy? How do we get the discrepancy?
Each time, when they added.
Yeah. The answer is, of course, that they changed the calendar.
Who changed the calendar?
The church changed the calendar. No. Several centuries ago, maybe about 2-3 centuries ago, okay? They decided that there was too much of a lapse between the calendar as it existed, what they called the Julian calendar, because this was the calendar which was arranged under Julius Caesar, and between the realities, because after several centuries they noticed that instead of the year being exactly 365 and a quarter days, which was the presupposition of the Julian calendar, in reality you have to also allow for fractions of days, okay? And so therefore they decided that they would make a change in the calendar, and the change in the calendar was by one of the popes by the name of Gregory. So this is what they call now the Gregorian calendar, okay? And of course there was a whole machlekas, as to whether to follow the Julian calendar or to follow the Gregorian calendar. The Eastern Orthodox Church, like the Russian Orthodox and the Greek Orthodox and so on to this day, they still follow the Julian calendar.
Uh-huh.
This is part of the reason why their Easter is different from the Catholic calendar, exactly. And it also accounts for the fact, that in America they began to adopt the Gregorian calendar roughly 1　So that Washington's birthday actually was not on the 22nd of February, it was on a different day. But they moved it to February 22nd when the calendar changed, you see. So that that's the only explanation I can give, for this, that in reality the calculations of those days were based upon the Julian calendar. They didn't know of any chokmahs about Gregorian, which came much later. So,
but the 60 days begin when? And what is the beginning point of the 60 days?
It begins with the time when the sun begins, it hits the equinox, okay?
Equinox.
The equinox means that the day and night are roughly the same at the equator, okay? That you have 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night. So you have the vernal equinox and the springtime, and then you have the autumnal one, speaking of autumn. But in our calendar, as I said, we celebrate it roughly around September 21st or something like that. But to account for that difference, this would explain the reason why. Okay. So,
why? I guess what I'm trying to ask is this maybe seems to ask the same thing. I'm not sure. It starts off Gimel Mar Heshvan, Shiva Mar Heshvan.
Right.
Very specific.
Right.
They're thinking about the.
The person who said Gimel Mar Heshvan, why, what the reason is not mentioned over here, but it's probably based upon something that we learned in the first pages. Namely that, when should we begin to say Masha Baruch? Okay?
Right.
So if we should begin to say Masha Baruch, according to one opinion, let's say on the sixth day, this was Rabbi Akiva's opinion, remember, on the sixth day of Sukkos, because he derives it from the fact that you have Mem, Yud Mem, mentioned in various days, so that he feels that this is the appropriate time to do it. So in that case, we can see easily, why, there would be a discrepancy of a few days between Gimel Mar Heshvan and, Zayin Mar Heshvan, okay? But they don't really explain why. It's just that this was, probably it was his personal view, okay?
I guess what I'm trying to ask is this, is that that, whether it's Gimel or Zion,
yeah,
is it's very affixed, first of all, to our calendar, Mar Cheshvan,
yeah,
and second, to a specific occurrence or condition, which is the progress of travelers.
Yeah, correct.
For,
right, right. I mean, Rav Gamaliel gives a very logical reason now, why, okay, it should be so. Yes,
now,
I agree.
From there,
yeah,
there's a jump,
right,
to 60 days.
Yeah.
But what is the 60 days tied to? It's tied to not to a calendar, not to a chag, not to a condition, but to a general weather condition, if you will.
Yeah, correct.
Now, how did that come about? I mean, how did, what it's like a big extrapolation. How,
okay,
did we go from one, right, concept to another?
Good. You have to say that the reason for that is as follows. First of all, that as we saw, Babylonia was not as dependent upon rain as Eretz Yisrael was. The rainy season in Babylonia begins sometime in Cheshvan, whatever it may be, okay? But much later anyway. Maybe even later than the Cheshvan, although some say that Cheshvan is the time when it begins over there too in Babylon. But it was not so dependent. Since it wasn't so dependent, they could pray for rain at different times other than in Eretz Yisrael. Still, you want to keep some sort of an identification of Eretz Yisrael, so that therefore, even though in Babylonia, maybe they didn't need the rain as desperately as they needed in Eretz Yisrael, but still they felt, you know, there comes a time when you have to also begin praying for rain. But there were also astronomers. Babylonians were great astronomers, and of course Shmuel was famous, you know, for his knowledge of astronomy. Remember what he said, you know, that he knows the streets of the Harda as well as he knows, you know, or rather, he knows the course of the sky, the stars of the sky, as he knows the streets of the heart. That's how familiar he is with that. So it was an old science in Babylonia, and therefore they could more or less predict when, according to their own personal circumstances, the fall season should begin, and then when the rainy season would be needed, let's say, in Babylon.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Okay.
So really,
now, of course, I mean, that brings us to the final question. Why do we in the Gola, after all, our conditions are not the same as Babylonian, but why do we in the Gola, whether it's in America or Britain or Canada or Australia or whatever it may be, why do we follow the practice of Babylonia? But that's the answer. Because Babylonia became sort of the symbol of lands outside of Eretz Israel, and that therefore the various minhagim that were followed in Babylonia, this became the basis for the minhagim that we follow. I mean, because otherwise, you know, you can say Talamadra all year round if you want. I mean, in America we have rain coming to
all the time.
By the way, one last word about rain. When we were in Eretz Yisrael, on Pesach, we actually, the last couple of days of Pesach, the fifth, the 6 days, we had rain over there.
See, it worked.
Yeah. So the point is, but we had already stopped saying Talamadra, right, we had already stopped saying Asher Baruch.
Right.
But if you remember, there was an opinion that we had in the Gemara where it says, you know, Ad Yavor Nisan, right? Which means that according to this minority opinion, you should continue saying it until the end of Nisan, because a rain might fall. And there is the proof, you see. It's what I quoted to some of the people, you know, who were surprised that it was still raining. Okay, weiter. Now the Mishnah continues and it says, Igia Yud Zayin B'Mar Cheshvan. Now what happens if the 17th of B'Mar Cheshvan comes? Lo Yodu Geshonim, and no rain has fallen as yet.
No, we're getting in trouble.
Right. So at this particular point, Iskilu HaYechidim Isanin Gimel Taniyos. Then individuals. Yochid, you know, means somebody who is individual.
Yochid.
Or if you wish, you can say a distinguished individual, okay, in order to bring out the force of this idea over here. So they began to fast. And they fasted 3 fast days. Ochlin, Vishosin, Mishachashecho. But these fast days are days in which they were permitted to eat and to drink as soon as it got dark, right? Mutorim bimlocha, and also they were permitted to do work on these days. Uvechitzo, they were permitted also to bathe, uvesicho, and, you know, to anoint themselves, uvenilas hasanu, to wear their shoes. Uvetashbish habita, they were also permitted even to have marital relations. Okay? So, the point that they're making is that even though these are fast days that they're observing, but they're not that stringent in the rulings, you know, as to what they have to observe. Unlike, for example, Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur, you know, where the night before is prohibited to do any of these things. Okay? All right. Now, time marches on. And now it's Rosh Chodesh Kislev. But rain still hasn't fallen. So in this case, now Bezdin goes in Sholosh Taniyah Salatziva. So the Bezdin now proclaims 3 fast days for the congregation, for the community. So that they have to fast.
In other words, the certain individuals did fast 3 days.
Right.
Bring the rain,
right?
And it didn't come, so now
it didn't come. So now they're asking the congregation, right? They're asking the community to fast, exactly.
Okay.
But again, with these fast days, it's ochlam mishos mishal sheichu. You're permitted to eat and drink after it gets dark. Mutom imloch. You're permitted to work. Rechisa v'sicha v'dinas hasandol v'tash v'shamin. Permitted to do all these various activities that we described before that the yechidim were permitted to do. So congregation too is permitted to do these acts, even though they must observe a fast. So now, of course, question number 1 that the Gemara wants to know is man yechidim. Who are these distinguished individuals that we're talking about? So Amar Rav Huna. Rav Huna said, Rabbonim. He says these are the rabbis. These are the distinguished ones. In other words, let them fast.
Is that the hate?
Right. The Yomar Rav Huna, another thing that Rav Huna said, he says, Yechidim Isanin Shaloishot Adios, he says, these distinguished individuals have to fast 3 fast days. And what are those 3 fast days? The answer is Sheni V'Chamishi V'Sheni. You have to fast on Monday, on Thursday, and on Monday of the following week. So now the question is, Michael Mashmalon, why these particular days? I mean, why can't you make, let's say, 3 days in a row? Or why can't you, let's say, start into fast first on Thursday, and then Monday, and then Thursday? Mm-hmm. Why does it have to be in the order of, as we would say, Bahat? In other words,
Monday, Thursday, Monday.
Why must it be like that? So he says, Tanino, the reason is because we learned in Gozrin Tani Salatzibur B'techilo B'chamishi. It says, we do not proclaim a fast series, so to speak, upon the congregation, upon the community, beginning on Thursday. Why? Shalola hapkias hashorim. It's in order not to cause prices to shoot up. If people
cause what?
Prices of food to shoot up. Thursday is close to Shabbos already. People are doing their buying for Shabbos, but they also have to buy for, you know, when the fast ends in order to eat a meal. So if the business people see that there's such a demand for food, what are they going to do? They'll raise the prices. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, we're familiar with the fact that you know, kosher poultry suddenly shoots up in price. Fish that I remember, you know, the fish also used to go up in price, right, before the Yontif and things like that. And so, you know. Or you go into the market and you see that the Pesach prices don't seem to bear any resemblance to
what they should be.
What they should be, exactly, and so on. you know, people are unfortunately taking
advantage
of the situation. So therefore, you should not begin a series of fasts on Thursday because it's much too close and it's going to cause prices to rise because the market people will take advantage of it. Elo Sholish Taniyos HaRishonos, but rather the first three Taniyos, the first three Tanesim should be Sheni V'Chamishi V'Sheni, right? It should be on Monday and on Thursday and on Monday.
But it has to do with Shabbos coming in between.
Yes.
Because Shabbos follows so closely after Thursday.
Right. Now we also have to bear in mind another thing. If it begins on Monday and people know that they're going to have to fast on Monday and on Thursday and on following Monday, so they have several days already in between in order to buy up food.
Prepare for it.
Prepare, exactly. So it wouldn't cause as great a hardship as it would be under the other circumstances, where you suddenly say, hey, we didn't have any rain, fast.
Is there any relation to the market days? Monday,
yes.
Thursday market
yeah,
days?
Of course, they were market days, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And these were days in which the Beis Din would meet, because people coming to the towns in order to do their shopping. So the Beis Din would meet on those days, and this is why we read the Torah on
Is this the basis
Monday,
for
Thursday.
Some people fasting on Mondays and Thursdays?
Yes. Yeah, there are people
who fast
right,
on Mondays
right.
and Thursdays.
First of all, there are a couple of times during the year, in the month of Iyar,
which is now,
right, after Pesach, and in the month of Cheshvan, which follows all the holiday seasons, that they fast. Bahat, they fast on Monday, Thursday, and Monday for 3 days, sort of to atone for the fact that they were having too good a time eating and drinking during the Yom Tov. Okay? And then, those who took upon themselves even a more stringent way of life decided that Mondays and Thursdays would be the days in which they fasted. So they say, Ma udeteimo, what if you should say, Hani mile tzibor? Okay, granted, if you proclaim a fast for the congregation, right, then in that particular case, we can understand. We've been given a reason why it should be on Monday, Thursday, and Monday, and not, let's say, on Thursday, Monday, and Thursday. Okay? Avod yochid loy. But we would say, in the case of the distinguished individual, what difference does it make? There's only a handful of them who are fasting. So it's not going to cause any fluctuation in the prices, right? If that's the case, then why should we say that it must be Sheni, Chamishi, Visheni? Maybe it could be some other sequence. So they say, Kamash Malon, this is the reason why we learn that no. The same thing applies to the Yochid, that he too has to fast on Sheni, Chamishi, and Sheni. Tanya Nami Hochi, and likewise we have another tradition where we learned that Sheizchidu HaYechidim Nisanes, that when these Yechidim, these individuals began their fasting, so Nisanen Sheni V'Chamishi V'Sheni, so they fast on Monday, Thursday, and Monday, but they stopped the fast, or in other words, they did not fast the Rosh HaKadoshim, neither on Rosh Chodesh. Let's say Rosh Chodesh comes on one of these days. Let's say it comes on a Monday or it comes on a Thursday, right? So if it's Rosh Chodesh, you don't fast on that day. Uvi Yomim Toivim, or on those holidays, Aksuvim Megillas Tainis, that are written in Megillas Tainis. Now this already is a different story. What is Megillas Tainis? The answer is that way, way back, this was still, while the Beis HaMikdash was still in existence, they compiled a list of special days in the calendar when people were not to fast and when people were not to observe mourning. because, you know, these were days that were festivals for different reasons. A victory on this day, a miracle on another day, and so on. And they had a whole list of these, and they were put together, and it was called Maseches Tainis, or Megillas Tainis, the scroll of fasting. Of course, it's just the opposite. It's those days upon which you don't fast, okay? But what happened with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? So the answer is that we say, for that particular point, the dates that are mentioned in Megillas Tainis, they were bottled, you know, with the exception, of course, of Hanukkah and Purim, which to these days, you know, we observe as days of celebrating the miracles, and therefore days upon which we are not to fast or to make hespedim on those days.
Is Purim occurred before the destruction of the second temple?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very of course, good. After all, it you know, it represents the fact that the Jews, in spite of the fact that they had a Beis HaMikdash, but they were all threatened, their lives were at stake. Yeah. And with Hanukkah, we know, you know, historically.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
research
and stuff
like that.
Yeah.
Where was the 3 centuries before Hanukkah?
Yeah.
Happened around 500, whereas Hanukkah happened about 165. So, approximately 3 centuries.
BCE.
Naturally. It's always funny with the BCE business because, you know, you have to think of, for example, 597 came earlier in the calendar than 586. Of course, we're working that way, right? Yeah. That was already in the common era.
Yeah,
that the second Beis HaMikdash was
While we're talking about the thing.
Right. Of course, the date of destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash was 586, but 597 is called the Siyar Yochum, when the Babylonians already took many of the Jews and took them into captivity in Babylonia, even though they did not yet destroy the temple, and they appointed Zedekiah as the king. Okay, let's continue. Learn about another 10 minutes or so. Okay. Tana Rabbana, sages have taught us. Al Yomar Odom Talmid Ani. A person should never say, "I am a Talmid Chacham."
Well, it doesn't say Talmid Chacham, just as Talmid.
Right. However, I am only a student. However, let's take a look at the Rashi over here.
Okay.
On the top line over there, you see? Talmid Ani says, V'eini choshev kol kach yechidim. And a person should never say that, you know, I am a Talmid, but not as important as these individuals. Kolaymer, in other words, eini ra'ui, I am not worthy enough la'aschil tanis im yechidim, that I'm not worthy enough to begin fasting together with the yechidim. Okay, so they're trying to say that you shouldn't feel so humble, but if you feel that, you know, you want to sympathize with the Yechidim who are fasting, then in that case you're allowed to do it. This is what the implication is. Elo, rather, he says, Kol Talmidei Chachomim, all the scholars, yechidim, are yechidim. In other words, once you commit yourself to the study of Torah, then you're like any of the distinguished individuals. So they say, now if that's the case, ezehu yochid, ezehu talmid. So give me a distinction, you know, tell me a definition. What is the difference between a yochid and between a talmid? Since the talmid also, by implication, is somebody who studies Torah, right? So they give the following explanation. They say, Yochid, a distinguished individual, is called Sheroyin Manoise Parnasalat Sibor. Whoever is worthy enough that you should make him an official over the community. In other words, in those days, they felt that you had to be a distinguished person, you had to have Torah and Mitzvahs and everything else in order to be a Parnasalat Sibor. They didn't know about Watergate or about the
White Watergate,
so on and so forth.
the kind of people that the American public chose, unfortunately. We'd like to say more about the state of Israel this evening. Well, a person, you know, in order to be a Pranas, you have to be a person of learning and all kinds of good mitzvahs. So this is a distinguished person. Talmud. And how do you define the word Talmud? So he says, Kol Shoshon and Oysi Devar Halacha B'Limudo. Any person to whom you can ask a question about what is the Halacha in the area in which he's studying, the Yomer, and he's able to give you an answer. Even in the Masechet Sekalot. Now, this last three words is the question, how do you understand one of these last three words? Okay? So, the answer is that, first of all, the word Kala can be understood in two different ways. Okay? We know that, for example, the word Kala means a bride. Okay, and there is a very small Masechta, which is not part of the regular Talmud, but it's really a compilation. It's a compilation of different varieties. Okay, and this is called Maseches Kala, and of course, it deals with two areas in general. Area number one is that it deals, of course, with questions about marriage. And the other one is that it deals with what we call derech eretz. In other words, how human beings should behave towards one another. Okay? So this is the thing. Now, since it was never part of the big Talmud, so in that particular case, what they're saying is that if you ask him, you know, a halacha, even if it's only about something which we find in Maseches Kala, and he knows how to answer it, so that already qualifies him as a Talmud or a Talmud Chacham. Okay.
Sort of like if today, I guess today it's almost if you ask somebody about Perkei Avot, which is supposed to be
right,
you know, less.
It's less difficult than sitting down and learning this, and then this is a little bit easier too than sitting down to learn, you know, some of the more complicated numerals. Yeah, no question about that. There are others who say that the word Kala, however, has a different meaning as well. Uh-huh. You've probably heard of the expression Yarche Kala. Yarche Kala is something which existed in Babylonia particularly, in the various yeshivas, and then it's carried on. That means that you spent a month prior to the high holiday season, or a month prior to Pesach, learning in the yeshiva, and people would come together and learn in those periods, and you know, they would choose a particular masechta in order to learn during that time. Usually it would be in connection, of course, with preparation for the various holidays, but that was also maseches. The kala may mean in connection with that. By the way, in Yerkum Purkum we still use the expression L'reishe kala, L'reishe misibosu, and so on and so forth. One of the Reishi Kala means those people, you know, who are the head teachers, so to speak, the lecturers during the Yarche Kala, when people gather by the thousand. So as I said, it's been revived in the yeshiva world today.
Kolel.
Well, Kolel is something that goes on all the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
And Kolel, you know, you realize it's for married men that they should be able to devote their time completely to the study of Torah, and they get a stipend for that, and then they try to make a living and have children and so on and so forth. Very often the wife has to do something too. For example, in Yerushalayim you find that the women are selling hats and coats and clothing that they get from their cousins in America and things like that, and so on. Anything in order to make a living, you know, to supplement the family income. So they're hard working, believe me. It's not easy to have a household of, you know, a household of children and try to make ends meet while, you know, your husband is off learning all day long. So, of course, not every
and
person, you know,
this has become a practice recently. It hasn't been a practice all the time.
Well, it existed already in the European yeshivas still. It did exist over there.
But particularly you see it now, not only in Eretz Yisrael, but of course you see it in American yeshivas as well.
But that wasn't a practice in ancient times. Ancient times, even the great rabbis had a trade. Everybody had trade. They all
right.
had a, and they all had a work.
Right.
And it's even in the Pirkei Avos, it says a man just studying Torah is not a complete man.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
You got to have a malacha.
Yeah. All Torah Shenu and Malochos of Betel and Gerer and Sovan. I mean,
right.
It'll come to naught and it'll lead to sin because of the fact if you don't have anybody going to do, how are you going to support your family?
Right. So,
well, there are different opinions even in the Pirkei Avot, but I think to give a little better perspective, many of these people in the Kollel, it's not as if they were like one of the Tanaim was a sandbar. It's not that they necessarily are cobblers or carpenters. So some are, but a lot of them do work as instructors. They'll go out schools
like
and
teachers.
Like
that. And they're working.
So they're working.
Right.
Maybe it's sometimes it's a part time and life work.
Today, one of the things they try to do is,
like,
for example, you have a yeshiva, so you try to get people in the kollel to go and to spend time in the afternoon, let's say, going over the Gemara, with the younger students and so on, so that they'll understand the text better, to understand what the Rebbe is teaching.
Other thing is that because I'm monopolizing everybody's time. But there's one, I can't think actually what it is now, but there's one staka that they send around their chaveret all the time, and it escapes me, but their system is that you contribute the money, all right, and they test the Talmidim every month.
Yeah,
and if they pass the
that's
test,
that's a different thing, right? That's called Mifal Hashas.
That's it,
Mifal Hashas. These are rabbonim and everything else, but young Yeshivalite who obligate themselves to learn a certain number of pages every month, and then they have to take a very strict exam to see whether they really have learned the plot well, or whether they're simply bottling.
Dogging it.
Right.
And if they pass, then they get the money for the next month.
Right.
And they have to do this every month. So this is an entirely a gravy train, as we would say in America.
And of course, I mean, the idea with the Kollel was really that eventually it would lead to great Talmidei Chachamim, the Talmidei Chachamim of the next generation. This was really the idea behind it.
I understand that.
Yeah. All right, gain a bit for the bike, and then we'll call it night. All right. Yeah, look, like anything else, there could be abuses, right? Tell me, Kosher Shalom, said the halacha be the mood of Yemen. Right, that's my son's comment. Turn around on it. Lo, call her Rotsa Lasso Satsbo Yochid Oise. Talmud Oise. Do it, Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that not everybody who wants to say, hey, I am a Yochid, deserves that title of Yochid, and not everyone who says, I am a Talmud, deserves that title either. In other words, it should not be a source, that you're trying to boast about yourself, but rather, you should really take seriously what qualities they represent before you claim such a title to yourself. Rabbi Yossi Yemer, Rabbi Yossi says, Aisa, Bezochelato, he says, look, if a person wants to undertake to call himself a Yochid or to call himself a Talmud and what? And fast, right? So Zochelotov, he should he should be blessed. Literally, may he be remembered for good. Why? Lefisha ain Shevach, because in the final analysis he's not doing it because he wants to have glory out of it. Elotzar hulo. Fasting is going to bother him. So in reality, he shouldn't be punished or degraded by the virtue of the fact that he wants to do whatever the Yechidim or the Talmidim are doing, as far as fasting is concerned. Tanya Yidoch, another interpretation that we had is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, but he says, Bamed Dvar Mamurim, what are we talking about? So he says, Bedover Shal Shevach, that's when it comes, you know, to getting praise. He has no business, you know, if he doesn't have the qualities, the qualifications, you know, to try to seek the praise of the Yochid or the Talmud. Avol Bedover Shal Tsar, but if something, you know, like fasting is concerned, and in that case, Ose, he's permitted to do the Zochlatov, and he should have, and he should be blessed for it. She'ein Shevach Ulo Elatzar Ulo, because it's not for praise, but rather it is a source of, discomfort and pain to him. Okay, I think that will stop at this particular point. And we've gone quite a bit, so we're now on the base over here. And roughly one third of the page down, right, on the rabbon. That's where we'll start. Okay, Don Rabbonim. It says, Mi shoyo misan el atzora v'yovra. Now, he says that if a person was fasting because there was a tzora, could be his own personal tzora, or might even be, you know, let's say that he was fasting because he heard that the city was going to be attacked, or for whatever reason it may be, okay? And at any rate, v'yovra. And then the tzora passed away. This is while he was still, of course, fasting, right? The very same day that it happened. Or al hachoyle in Isrape. Or maybe he was fasting because he was praying, you know, he was fasting so that somebody who was very sick should get
a refuah shleima,
and that person got better. So the din is harezem isanim hashem. He has to continue fasting and complete the fast. In other words, the fact that whatever the tzora was or the illness, you know, the crisis has passed, does not excuse him. If he undertook that he was going to fast for this specific purpose, then in that case he must complete his fast.
When he commits himself, does he commit himself to a specific time?
Yeah. Normally, a person commits himself to fast from sunrise until sunset. That's the usual type of a fast, okay? Of course, if a person wants to take upon himself even greater severity, then in that case he might decide that he wants to begin fasting, let's say, from the eve that precedes until, the following eve. But it's a general rule that it's already an unusual type of fast.
How would one recover in such a short period if it's less than a day?
We're talking about the person who was sick who recovers. I would say that's the case. Let's say that this person had been, that the crisis passed that particular day. I mean, we know that there are times when a person has a tremendous fever, for example. And, you keep
fever
on hoping
breaks.
It could be right. And then all of a sudden there comes that magic moment when the fever breaks,
right.
You know. So that this is probably what they have in mind. So, if you undertake the fast, in that case you have to complete the fast. Now we have another idea connected with fasting. It says over here, "Ha'hoydech me'mokem she'ein misan ne'mokem she'misan." If a person goes from a place where they are not fasting to a place where they are fasting, in other words, let's say he goes from a city where it's not in danger or anything like that, and therefore it was not necessary to proclaim any special fast. But he goes now and he arrives at a community where people are fasting for whatever reason may be, whether it's for lack of rain or because they heard threat, you know, that there's an army approaching, whatever it may be, that they proclaim a Tanisti before. And this, of course, now is not an individual fast, but we're talking about a Tanisti before. And a person, you know, who's an individual comes to a place where they are fasting, then in that case, what is the din? So Harei Zeh Misanim Mohim. He has to fast together with them. Now, what happens if Mimbokem Shemisanim, the city that he left, was a place where they were fasting? Lemokem Shemisanim, he comes to a place where they're not fasting. So nevertheless, what is his din? His din is again, Harei Zeh Misanim Umashnim. He has to complete the fast for himself. Okay? Shochach, the Ochal Vishoso. What happens if he forgot? Because, you know, let's say at this particular point, he was, he eventually was fasting, but everybody else was eating and drinking, right? So in that particular case, he forgot, and he ate and he drank. So, Al Yisroel Bifnei HaTzibur. Then in that case, he should not appear before these people, that is, before the people who are fasting in this particular case, right? Nor should he carry on with all kinds of pleasurable acts by himself. In other words, the first instance was the fact, you know, where First of all, he went from a place, right, where they weren't fasting to a place where they were fasting. So in that case, what is the din? The din is that you have to show the sympathy for the people, you know, in whose midst you are, and therefore you have to do what they are doing. If they are fasting, then in that particular place, you also have to undertake to fast. And then the second case was he left a place where they were fasting and he came to a place where they weren't fasting. So he should still continue his fast. And what would happen if, as I say, you know, he sees everybody else in another community where he comes to and they are fasting and he eats and he drinks and so on. So in that case, he should not publicly display the fact that he's eating and drinking or carrying on any pleasurable activities. Why? Because you have to show sympathy for the people in whose midst you are. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Vayomer Yaakov Levonov, that Jacob said to his sons, Lomo Tisro, why should you literally look at yourself? But Omar Lehem Yaakov, this is how they teach it. They say what Jacob said to his sons actually was Al Tiru Atzbechem or Al Taru Atzbechem Shatem Sebeim Lo Bifnei Esav Lo Bifnei Yishmoel, right? That you should not give yourself the appearance that you are sated with food. In other words, you are enjoying life, you're eating, you're drinking, you're having all good things. Don't do it either in the presence of Esav, nor in the presence of Yishmael, Kedei shel yiskanu bochem, so that they should not become jealous of you. All right, now of course, actually over here, we have two basic dinim that we went over. I mean, that is that they have consequences. The first one is the far, you know, let's say if a person comes, you know, I had this experience in Israel. What does a person from Chutz La'aretz do when he comes to Eretz Yisrael? They are observing one day Yontif, right? So what are we expected to do? Are we expected to, simply scrap the second day Yontif because nobody else is doing it? The answer is no. We have to observe it just as the person, let's say, who came from a place where they were fasting and he comes to a place where they're not fasting, so he still has to complete his fast. Of course, what is the opposite situation when the person comes from Eretz Yisrael? So the answer is that if a person comes from Eretz Yisrael and he expects to return to Eretz Yisrael, of course we're not talking about those who come to America and decide to make it their permanent home. But let's say that they intend to go back to Eretz Yisrael. Then what do they do? The answer is that privately, they only have to observe what? One day. Okay. But they should not then go around in the community and write, go to the movies and do things like that and so on. As I've seen, some Israelis do, you know, that to them it's a vachadikatog and that's it. But they have to have respect for the feelings of people in the community in which they are. So that it's something, you know, that they should bear in mind. Yes.
I remember, I don't know if you remember this man, or the one that was the naval commander, though he worked on Cole Morgan as a production VP officer. But he was a hero in me. But.
I don't think he was there.
Oh, he was a.
He was a secular Jew.
Secular man. But you, on this point, he was very firm that on. Take a day like second day of Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah, well, Rosh Hashanah the day observed 2 days in Eretz Yisrael also, right?
Okay,
all right. Yeah.
Second day of
right,
Sukkot.
But it would be, you know, the Shal Shogon that we're talking about. Okay. Yeah.
Second day of Sukkot, whatever. He made a point. He was telling me, he said, "No, I stay at home. I don't go to shul." Well, I know I didn't go to shul on the first day either, but I don't go, I never take the car out and drive it out because I don't want to offend the feelings of the Jews here. So we really just stay at home and don't show ourselves.
Right, right. All right.
That's interesting.
It's
very interesting what you said.
Is there a time limit? For instance, a man comes here, let's say, stays here 3-4 years. And then eventually he expects to go back, but he came here for a number of years.
I would say that anybody who's going to be here for 3 years should certainly begin to observe 2 days Yom Tov. This is my own personal feeling. Now, I'm not telling that I'm not making this as a statement that this is halacha, but this is my own personal feeling. If you're staying this long, then by all means, observe.
I know that they do. I mean, because Mr. Gill did, Rav Gill did observe, even though he's going back in June.
Right.
As I was reading in this book, as looking at this book about, it was written by Herzog's father.
Yeah.
And it's like, let's say, it's like, Shana, I forget what the name was, Shana something, I have to tell you, but what it was, he gave like a little like Luach Dini and Nidchak Dini. He was talking about the second Shmiri Atzeret. And he says, if you come from Chutz La'aretz and you intend to go back to Chutz La'aretz, okay, then you and you're in Israel where we only sit 7 days in Sukkah. You don't have to sit in the Sukkah.
Yeah,
it's kind of interesting.
Well, this is a question exactly what to do. But there's a day on the Shulchan Aruch even about living in Galut and whether you should eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres or not. Many people say you should, okay, but there are those who say that no, it's no longer Sukkah, it's no longer an obligation. Obviously, everybody's thinking that even if you do go into the Sukkah,
it's
you don't make
the
it rough anymore. Yeah.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah. But, you know, as to whether you're obligated to do it or not, there's a difference of opinion about that. All right. Now, the statement that I wanted to make was, you know, about what did we just learn over here? About what was Yaakov telling his sons? What was he telling them? He was telling them that a Jew has to be very, very circumspect. And this is a lesson that I wish that many Jews would learn also in our own day. That, you know, you don't go around wanting your wealth, your influence,
authority,
the jewelry and everything else and so on, because whether it's Bifnei Esav, who represents the Christian world, or Bifnei Yishmael, who represents
the Arab
world, the Muslim world, right? They're only going to provoke jealousy by doing so. And at times, there's no question that, you know, the goyim have been provoked. Look, all you have to do is to listen to the propaganda of a Farrakhan or any of his cohorts, you know, how they denounce the Jews, that they own everything. Obviously, we know it's a lie. And thank God there are enough people who will defend the Jews under these circumstances, too. But still, there are times that we know ourselves, I mean, that Jews have provoked envy on the part of others. Yes?
Talking about therapy, I don't know what's going on, right?
Yeah.
They had to go in the garage on State Street this week. They got a big sign. I heard a loudspeaker in Winchester Square. It says, Fair Canaanite, and it blasted this message out into the street.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're saying. I didn't stop to listen, but I hope they got it.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Irv, did you notice when we drove through Memorial Square, there was a black woman over there? Did you see her spit on my car?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I was behind you.
Right. I didn't know whether you noticed.
That was not Memorial Square. That was...
That's Winchester Square.
Winchester Square, yes. I sure did notice
her.
I don't know why she did that.
Why? To show a contempt for me because I was white, I guess.
Well, I was white too. How could you, you know?
Well, she could only aim at one. I was the kapora.
Nope. So, sie seine kapora.
Right. Okay, let us continue right now.
All right.
So, since they already mentioned this pasuk about Yaakov and his sons, you know, this, of course, is all part of the story about going down to Egypt. So Vayom Yaakov Vonov, right? What Lomot Yisroel? Why should you look at each other? In other words, as we saw it interpreted, don't don't display your wealth and your all the pleasures that you have in life and so on. So in order not to provoke enmity, so they take another pasuk. In this particular case, this is Joseph who's telling his brothers that they should go back to Egypt, they should go back to Canaan and bring Yaakov, right? And he warns them and he says, Al tirgizu b'dorah, which means literally, don't get into a rage on your way.
Okay,
this is the literal translation, yeah. But how do they touch it? So Amar Rabbi Elazar, touches it, he says, Amar lehem yoisef liyechov. That Joseph said unto his brothers, he says, "Al tisasku b'dvar halacha, shema tirgizu aleichem hador." Don't indulge in dvar halacha, lest the road literally become angry with you. In other words, lest you have trouble on the road. Lest, as Rashi says, tisor. In other words, you will wander off and you'll get lost on the way. Now, the problem is, what is he telling them? Al tisasku b'dvar halacha. I think that we have to say that what Joseph is telling his brothers is that don't get involved in all kinds of philosophical discussions as to whether you did right, whether you did wrong in selling me and so on as a slave into Egypt. This is not the time. The time is the time for action. Time is go back to Egypt, bring our father and bring your families, your wives, children, so on, to each of them. Don't get involved with it. But the Gemara now says, Eini, is this so? In other words, that you shouldn't have a Devar Halacha while you're going on the road, lest the road becomes difficult, you'll get lost. Well, Omar Rabbi Eloi Bar Berechi, didn't Rabbi Eloi Bar Berechi say that Shnei Talmidei Chachomim Shemahalchim Baderach, that if you have two Talmidei Chachomim who are going on the road, the Yain Beinehem Divrei Torah, and there is no words of Torah among them. In other words, if they walk along and all that they do is to have idle talk, as we would say, Devon Betalim, that they're discussing, instead of talking about Torah. So Re'uyim Lissarev says, they deserve being burnt. What do you mean being burnt? Shenebar. And they bring a pasuk about what happened with Eliyahu Hanavi. He was walking with Elisha, his disciple, right? So vayhi hemer holchim holoch v'daver, they were holoch v'daver, and they were going and they were talking. Obviously, what would Eliyahu and Elisha talk? They have to talk the very Torah, right? Okay. So v'hinei rechav eish, and behold, there was a chariot of fire, v'susei eish, and the horses of fire, v'yachridu ben shneihem, and they separated the two of them. So he says, tamo de'ikot dibor. In other words, why were they spared when the fire came? The fire, they could have all been burnt alive, right? So why were Eliyahu and Elisha spared? So the answer is the Ikodibor, because they had words of Torah among them.
They were spared.
All Ikodibor, but if they didn't, then in that case, Ruin Lisorif, then they would have been worthy of being burnt alive by the fiery chariots and the fiery horses. So he says, Loikashi says, no, it's not really a contradiction between one statement that says, don't involve yourself in the Divrei Halacha, and the other one says that you should be. Because he says the difference is, all the migros, lo the inuyan. He says the migros, which means that, you know, to talk about the thing, but not going into any deep pilpul, so to speak, this you should be doing on the road. But don't get involved with all kinds of iyun. Iyun over here means that you're starting to philosophize, you're starting to pilpulize, and so on and so forth. Don't get involved in that kind of discussion, because when you're traveling on the road, you don't know what kind of dangers are going to face you, and it's not the point. I mean, what you want to do is to arrive safely at your destination. Yes.
What Yosef was worried about, was it more what you just stated, or was it more that he was worried about fighting, breaking out between the brothers?
Well, that's the first part. I'll take you to Madura. Yeah, that's no question about that. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, you have to always remember, I mean, as I stress week after week, it's the difference between the pshat of the pasuk and, you know, how they interpret the pasuk for purposes of drash. Because in purposes of drash, what you're doing, I had a teacher many years ago, Rabbi Sholem. He was a wonderful teacher. And
what was his name?
His name was Rabbi Chertoff, Rabbi Paul Chertoff. He was the first teacher that I really had, you know, for Mishnah and Gemara and so on. So if anything, I learned at least the Derech. I remember he was a rabbi for a few years before he gave it up, and his devoted his full time to teaching. He says, you know, he says a text is a pretext. In other words, you have a pasuk, but in reality it's a pretext for trying to bring out the message drash, that you want drash to bring out. Right, so this is the drash, you see. That's the difference between those. Bimasti Satorna. Then we have another tradition which teaches us Altafsiu Pasiu Gasa. In other words, Altigus Badara, they give another interpretation, which is what? Don't take giant steps. Because you wear yourself out, I guess that's the basic idea. So walk humbly and walk modestly when you're on the road, okay? Not only that, but also Achnisu Chamolo Ir. And also, literally, you should cause the sun to enter the city. Meaning what? It means very simple. What it means is, when you do your traveling during the day. Don't travel at night, because at night you don't know what kind of sakonas there are on the road. There could be people lying in wait, ambush, and so on. I mean, we know ourselves. I mean, that you can feel perfectly safe in the daytime and not so safe if you have to walk at night. So this is what he's telling them. He's telling him Prost and Hoshad. He says, Al Tigris Vador, make sure, he says, that Achnisu Kamala here, that when you go during the daytime when the sun is shining. Al Tafsir Psir Kasa, why not Al Tafsir Psir Kasa, you know, to take giant steps, the Umar, because one of the authorities said, one of the teachers said, Psir Kasa Netelesecha Nechamesh Bayos Bimore Nov Shalot. He says that if you take steps like that, it's going to reduce your keichas. Not very much. 1/500th of the light of the eyes of a human being. In other words, it diminishes a certain, you know, potential strength that you have by that much. Of course, we would say 1/500th is not a heck of a lot, you know. But still, the idea is that a person should take care of himself, know what his limits are, and not, you know, try to exceed the limits if it's going to be injurious to his own health. A lot of people today, you know, are busy with weightlifting and running and everything else. But every once in a while, I read in our daily newspaper, they write into the doctor over there,
And, you know, they ask him, can I do this, can I do that, and so on and so forth. And, you know, he has to caution people that they shouldn't overtax themselves, because it is possible to bring about a result which is not that good. V'achnisu chamo lo ir, ked Rav Yehuda omer Rav, as Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, the omer Rav Yehuda omer Rav, he says, li'olam, always, yeitze yod bechitov, a person should leave when it is kitov, in other words, the best condition, v'yekoneis bechitov, and he should also enter, in other words, he should arrive at his destination when it is kitov. Now, of course, the question is, what is kitov?
Daytime.
Why? Vayar lehim esor kitov, right? God saw that the light was good, so that therefore take advantage of the light. This is when you should be doing your traveling. And they bring another pasuk again from the story of Yosef to show that the brothers Taka did that. Shenema, the pasuk says, Haboker or, that when morning became light, Va'anoshim shulchu, and then that's when the people were sent back, or were sent away. Of course, who were the people? So the brothers of Joseph, right, if you remember. And afterwards, then they had their tzoras, when Joseph sent his cops after them to accuse them of having stolen the goblet, the bech, right? Okay. But at any rate, even they knew, they had enough seichel that when they were permitted to leave Joseph's presence, it was already morning. Omer Rav Yehuda, Omer Rabbi Chiyo, Amahaleich Vadera, he says, if a person is going on the way, in other words, he's traveling on the road. And remember, we have to remember again that in those days, if a person didn't have the wherewithal to get into a wagon or whatever it may be, or ride on a horse or a donkey or something like that, how did they travel from one place to the other? The answer is what we call Shank's Mare. They went with their feet and farting. So, that being the case, he says, if somebody is walking on the way, is taking a journey, says, Ayochal Yosef Mishneira Avon, he should not eat more than he would if it was a year of famine. In other words, restrict your diet. Don't overeat if you have to walk on the way. My Tamo, what's the reason? So he says, Hocho, meaning here, in other words, in Babylonia, remember this, the Babylonian Talmud. So, Hocho, here in Babylonia, Targimu, they explain that the reason you should not overeat if you're going on a trip is Mishum Mayona, lest that you'll have, the runs, okay? And needless to say, if you have the runs, it will force you, right, to slow down, right, and you wouldn't be able to keep up with other people who are going in the same journey with you. B'ma'arava, in Eretz Yisrael, literally in the West, there they gave a different explanation. Amre, they said it's Mishum Zoyne. Says there, they said the reason why a person should eat sparingly is because if they're on a trip, they don't know whether they'll be able to secure more food easily. Right. In other words, they may not necessarily find an inn or Howard Johnson's or something like that, or a grocery store, nearby, 7-Eleven, where they could go and they could pick up food. So that being the case, they should eat sparingly in order to make sure that the food that they have with them will be able to last them during the trip. My benaihu. So now the question is, so what is the practical difference between them? So he says, you could be naihu, there is a practical difference. The yasid the arba. If a person, for example, is traveling and he's sitting in a boat. Why? Because if he's on the boat, the chances are, that over there he could find food, or maybe not find food. I mean, this is not, it's not result. But the point is that, it could be either a case of that you will get shilshul on the way, which would be a catastrophe. On the boat, I don't know what he's supposed to do if he's traveling on the boat, and he gets attacked about diarrhea or something like that. So that this would justify the opinion that says eat sparingly so that you don't have diarrhea. And as far as the food is concerned, well, it depends where the boat is. I mean, if they bring along enough food, it's one thing. But what if they also didn't bring up too much food? In that case, you have to learn how to eat sparingly and judge on that basis.
Anybody that's sailing a boat.
Yeah.
Of course, be mollified not to eat or drink very much.
Yeah, you could get seasick. But remember, their traveling was not necessarily on the ocean. They did a lot of traveling by boat. And remember I mentioned last week that Babylonia was situated between two major rivers, and then they had a whole network of canals that cut between the two. So people very often would travel by boat from one area to another. You see, it was quite common. So I don't know whether traveling on the Tigris or the Euphrates is going to make you seasick the way it would if you're traveling on the ocean. But nevertheless, look, there are always people who are bad travelers. No question about that. People get into a car and, you know,
barf the
way. Well,
right.
Try to imagine stuff on a small sailboat in the Canara.
When I was in the Canara, we took that little boat, you know, that goes across from Tiberia to Engedi over there. Well, I suppose a small boat would be a little different.
A little different.
I mean, after all, the New Testament has a scene where Yoshki, you know, is in trouble. The fishermen are out there on the lake over there, and all of a sudden a strong wind comes and the water becomes choppy. So, of course, he performed a miracle and quieted down the waters, but that's besides the point. I'm only interested in the point of view that it can be, you know, that sometimes even going in the Kinneret could also be a dangerous experience. Okay? Alright. Inami, or another possible practical difference, is because of the Abdul Rabna, if he goes from one place where they have an inn to another place, in other words, you know that you're going to find inns all along the way, then in that case, what? Then if you want to feel, you know, you want to eat, eskazuntai, because you know that you'll be coming pretty soon to another place where you can eat. Rab Papa, and now they give an example. The Rab Papa called Parsa or Parsa Achil Chadarif. Every single parasang that he traveled, remember we said the parasang last week was somewhere around 2.5 to 3 miles. Okay? So every time that he traveled, another parasang, so he ate a loaf of bread. Now, why did he eat a loaf of bread? Because of Mishamayon. His theory was, you know, not that he was going to run out of food, but rather he was afraid that if he didn't eat, he might develop shilshul. This way, he felt, you know, that when he ate, he felt better, and so he was able to travel in peace. So Rashi has some comment over here. All right, we'll take a look at Rashi where it says called Parso Parso Akalimba, right?
Yep.
Okay, so it says Kosovar Papa, he says that Papa was of the opinion that Hode Murabonan Lo Lechul Tvei, where the rabbi said you shouldn't eat too much, Mishuma Yono, because you know you're going to have diarrhea. So the Ihu Lo Mistofim Mayona. He was not worried about diarrhea. Why? The Valbet and Hava. Because he happened to be a guy with a great big belly. Inyan Acher, Kreisei Rechova. Or is another place that says that he had a great big stomach. The Isab above Messiah, as Gemara says above Messiah. The Kachoshev, Abrei, the Rav Popo. With, you know, talking about Rav Popo, Ucheish Gevuraso. That according to the man, so is his strength. In other words, he was a very healthy eater, a big eater, and it never seemed to bother him. So lefichoch, therefore, says yochol echol harbe in the mazik lo, he was able to eat a lot and it didn't bother him. So you have people like that; they're lucky. Yes.
Do you remember in Bracha? I forget which parak. they had a discussion, and one of the Tanaim used to eat like the equivalent of a sabar, but like bushels and bushels. You wouldn't have remembered.
Yeah, but if you remember over there.
This wasn't Rav Papa, was it?
No, it wasn't. Yeah. But we had earlier over here, the other week, we had I forget already who it was exactly who said, but, you know, he came from Eretz Israel to Babel and he saw that the people were eating over there. He says, in Babylonia, you know, a whole bushel of dates costs only, like a nickel or something like that. And in other words, if your food is so plentiful over here, how come you're not studying Torah? So he went and he ate taka, a bushel of dates, and then what happened?
He got sick.
He had diarrhea. So afterwards, as it says over there, it's like knives were piercing.
They describe it.
So then afterwards he says, look at these people in Babylonia. He says, they have so much poisonous food over here, and still they find the time to go to study Torah.
Very good.
Omar Rav Yehuda, Omar Rav. Another statement of Rav Yehuda, the name of Rav, says, Kol amar v'atzo b'shtei ro'avon nitzam b'nisim shonim. It says, whoever will starve himself in years of famine, you know, if it happens to be a time of famine, and you don't, you eat very sparingly, then nitzam b'nisim shonim, then in that case you'll be spared from an unusual death. A missing machine, you know, in Yiddish they use the.
It's a line never not missing.
So, what is a missing machine? So, Rashi tries to give an explanation. What is a missing machine? See, that's the next Rashi over there. It says, Meis Becherev, a missing machine is a person who dies by the sword, over of, or by hunger, right? The Chol Miso Shein Amidei Malach Amovis. In other words, any kind of a death which is not a kind where a person simply expires in his own bed, you know, the malcha mazal takes him in his bed, in other words, it's the normal way of dying. So any other way, you know, through accidental death or whatever it may be, this is a misimishim. Okay. So he says, if you eat sparingly in a time of famine, then you will be spared a missing mishun. Shenemar, and he quotes a book. He quotes the book of Job. He says, Barov totcham imovitz. During famine, he redeemed you from death. Meirov, he says, ben boyle. He says the Chura said that from famine he redeemed you from death. Elohochi kaomar, but this is what the pasuk implies. He says, because of the fact that in the time of famine he ate sparingly, he starved himself, so therefore this is why he was spared from a mishnah, which would have happened had he died of famine. Omar Reish Lakish, Reish Lakish said, also the yodam neshamesh mitosei b'shnei ravon, says a person should not have marital relations with his wife during the time of famine. Shenemar, as it is written concerning Yosef. It's written, remember, in Parsha Miketz. It's written over there, the Yosef Yulachne von him, Beterem Tovish Nasarov, that Joseph, unto Joseph were born two sons before the year of famine arrived. So from this, what do we learn? We learned that why didn't Joseph have more children afterwards? Because of the famine. And during famine, he felt it was not right to have relations with his wife at that time. That's why he didn't have more children. Tana, we have, however, another teaching that says that Chatzuchei Bonim, if people are bereft of children, they don't have children, then in that case, Misham Shemit, they say Mishnei Rabban, and they are permitted, you know, to to have relations with their wives in the years of famine, because after all, the mitzvah then of having a child outweighs the mitzvah of fasting during a time of starvation. Tanu Rabbanan, our sages taught, Bizman Shei Yisrael Shiruyim B'Tzar, when all Israel is enveloped in sorrows, in sadness and sorrow, Uferash Echad Mehem, and someone says that he separates himself from them. In other words, he doesn't want to take part in the sorrows or the distress, the problems of the Jewish people. He separates himself and doesn't want anything to do with them. So then the two angels who accompany each and every person, they come and they lay their hands upon his head, the omrim, and they say, Ploni zeh sheperash min atzibur, this individual who has separated himself from the community, al yireh b'nocha masasir, then may he not see the salvation or the consolation of the community. In other words, when things turn better, may he not be able to rejoice together with the congregation when the community get better for them. Tanya Idach, another similar teaching, is Mansha Atzibu Shavir B'Tzar, when the community is enveloped in sorrow, Adyumar Odom, the person should not say, Eilech Babesi, I'll go home, the Ochal, the Eshte, I will eat, and I will drink, v'sholom alayach davshi, and my soul, you'll enjoy life. Yimo sekein, but if he does so, then all of our kosev omer, then concerning him, the pasuk says, v'hinei sosoin v'simcho, and behold, there was rejoicing and festivity, horog bokor, slaying of cattle, v'shachot zon, the shechting of the sheep, achol basar v'shasos yayin, they were eating meat and drinking wine, achol v'shaso, eat and drink, kimochon avus, because tomorrow we will die. Of course, this is, even in Yeshayahu's time, there were people who said that this should be the philosophy of life. Eat, drink, lesson, and lebanah, guten tog, and so on and so forth. And this at a time when things were not going good. Nevertheless, they were only interested in themselves and in their own enjoyment of life. So Marcus in Basre, what do we find written in Yeshayahu following this pasuk? It says, V'diglo b'yoznei, that unto my ears there was revealed Adonai Tzvavos, God revealed himself. And what did he say? He said, "In yichupar ho'avon hazelochem atemusan, your sin will never be forgiven unto you until you die." So, and now the Gemara adds, "Atkan midas benonim." And here we're only talking about average people that they did this. Avol the midas v'shoyim, but as far as the wicked who deliberately, want to live a wicked life. Markasiv, what's written over there? Well, they say, Esoyu Ekho Yayin, come bring and I will have wine. Benispe or Sheikhon, let's get drunk with strong drink. The Hoyokaze Yom Ochor, and it's the same thing will happen tomorrow. In other words, we're doing it today and we'll do it tomorrow, and this is what we'll do day after day. So, Mark Simbasrei, what's written after them? What's written is Hatzadik Ovad, that the righteous perish, Yein Ishtam Alei, and nobody pays any attention, Ki Mipnei Hara'o Nesaf Hatzadik, that the Tzadik has been gathered, in other words, that the Tzadik has passed away because of the evil in the generation. Eli Yitzar Odim Matzivon, but rather, what should a person do? A person should, as we say, he should engage in sorrow and, you know, in self-deprivation, together with the community, together with the congregation, Shekein Motzinu B'Moshe Rabbeinu, because we find that this is exactly what happened in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, Shetzir Atzbo Im Hatzibur, that he identified himself with the congregation and he sorrowed together with them. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, and of course this, if you remember, was the incident concerning Amalek, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's written over there, V'yedei Moshe Kvedim, that Moses' hands became very heavy, V'yikhu Evan, and so they took a stone, of course this was Aaron and Kor, so they took a stone, V'yosimu Saptov, and they placed it underneath him, V'yeshuv Alev, and he sat on it. So the Gemara says, "V'chilo hoyelo leMoshe kar achas or keses achas leishiv aleho." Do you mean to tell me that Moshe Rabbeinu did not have a cushion or a pillow that he could have sat on it? Elokachom Moshe. But this is what Moshe said. He says, "Hoil the Yisrael shehuyim betzar, inasmuch as the people of Israel are suffering distress. So af ani eye imohem betzar. I too will be with them." In distress, the Chol Hametzayr Atzbo Natzibur, and whoever will bring distress unto himself together with the congregation, whoever, in other words, will suffer together with the congregation, then Zoche Veroe Menach Masir, then he will be worthy enough that he will see that the entire community, including him, of course, will be will receive consolation. The things will become better for them. And will turn from sadness to rejoicing. B'shema Yomar Adam. And now getting back to the person who says, I'll go in my house, but nobody will see me, right?
So lest the person should say, me may eat me, and who's going to testify against me, you know, that I was eating and drinking and living, and living a chazal shum tog, as we would say. He says, you know who? It's Avnei Beisu Shel Adam, Ikiris Beisu Shel Adam.
It is actually the stones in the home of a human being or the walls of the house of this human being. May Idinbo, they will testify against him. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, the Pasuk in Habakkuk, where it says, Ki Evan Mikir Tizak, that even a stone will cry out from the wall. V'chafis Me'etz Ya'anena. And like a stone, so it will answer it from the very wood of the house. In other words, the very home that a person lives in will testify against him.
Rabbi,
yes.
Doesn't Moshe Rabbeinu say gives out the curses and blessings to heaven and earth to testify to those people in the house made from this world?
All right, it's a nice idea. Yeah. But what he's trying to say, of course, is this. I mean, a person thinks that he hides himself in his home. Nobody will see whatever he does. But the truth of the matter is that even the home itself will eventually give evidence against him that, you know, what his actions were in defying the community and not feeling the same pain and sorrow that they have. Yes? Yes, yes, right. Know what is above you, of course. Ayin roh over you, the Shema's right. That the Rabbeinu Shalom has an eye that sees, and an ear that hears. V'chol ma'asecha b'sefer nechtavim, and everything is written down in the Rabbeinu Shalom's books.
That, in light of what Jerry, I find it strange that they speak of stones and walls rather than Kodesh Baruch Hu.
No.
Reason for this,
yeah, but they will testify before the Rabbeinu Shalom. That's the point. They will give testimony. After all, if a person does something, how can he be convicted? It can be convicted either by his own confession, or it can be convicted by evidence. But, you know, here he is alone. There's no other human being seeing what he's doing, that he's eating and drinking, right? But the answer is that the very stones in the very walls of his house, they will be the Edom against him when he faces his maker.
Well, okay.
Okay? Well, I mean, it's a poetic idea, but we can understand it easily enough. Naturally, the idea is, you know, that people should feel that they're part of the community, and if the community is in sorrow, then you have to feel pain together with them. Devei Rabbi Shila, in the school of Rabbi Shila, Amrei, they said as follows: Shnei Malachi Ashoes Amlavin LeYodo, the two angels who accompany a human being, Hein Meyidin LeLov, they're the ones who will give testimony concerning him. Not the stones of the house, but the two angels that accompany everyone. Shneimar, as the pasuk says, Ki Malochu Mitzavaloch, that God commands his angels concerning you, that they should take care of you, but at the same time they witness what kind of a life you're leading. Rabbi Chitko Emer, he has a different interpretation. He says, Nishmoso shall